Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Bamidbar and Yom Yerushalayim. A couple of announcements. The first is that the Pardes Executive Learning Seminar will be held this summer, July 3rd through 7th. And on July 8th, there's an optional excursion, including a visit to ancient Shiloh and the Piscot Boutique Winery. Sounds pretty good. And you can experience all of that along with the best teachers for Judaism are at Pardes, and you can experience them during the Executive Learning Seminar. Full details at pardes.org.il. I urge you to sign up and come to Jerusalem to study with our faculty. Also, this summer at Pardes is the Pardes Summer Program. More intensive, lasts a little longer. It's open for people 19 years of age or older. And the first session will be July 10th through the 28th. The second session, July 31st through August 11th here in Jerusalem. Please check out all the details at our website, pardes.org.il. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Bamidbar and Yom Yerushalayim. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parsha Bamidbar. And this week we engage in a carnival of counting as we count the Israelites, we count Bnei Yisrael in the wilderness. And that's exactly how the parsha begins. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe, Bamidbar Sinai, and Hashem speaks to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai and tells him, Su'et Rosh Kol Adat Bnei Yisrael, count the heads of the entire community of Israel, Lemishpachotehem lebeit avotam, according to their families, their ancestral houses, Vemispar Shemot, Kol Zachar legulgulotam, they should be counted by their names, by the number of names, each male head by head. Miben Esrim Shana v'mala, the count goes from 20 years old upwards. Kol Yotzei Tzava b'Yisrael, all who go out to war in Israel, Tifkdu Otam L'Tzivotam, Atavi Haron, you and Aaron should count them together. The question that is frequently posed when we are looking at this parsha, because the truth is, it is quite a tedious portion. What we're reading here is a set of statistics. You will see as you read through chapter 1, chapter 2, what we have is a very, very technical list of tribes with the precise numbers of the men in each ancestral unit. And then in chapter 2, we have a recount and a plan of how the Israelite camp is set up, where each tribe encamps, who to the east, who to the west, who to the north, who to the south. Each of their flags, we see their standards, their flags. Quite a technical story here. And I guess the question that we might want to ask is, what is the purpose of all this counting? We already know that when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were listed as being 600,000 strong. Once again, they were counted in the construction of the tabernacle, construction of the Mishkan. So why do we need to engage in such a laborious process of counting the people? I'm going to give three different approaches as to how to deal with this question. And then, maybe if we have some time at the end, we will focus or maybe draw our attention a little bit to Yom Yerushalayim. Let's begin with the Rashbam. Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, gives us a wonderful explanation, which I think works very, very well logistically. And the Rashbam says, "Lefi she'me'ata tzrichim lalecha le'eretz Yisrael, uvenei esrim ro'yim latzeit b'tzava ha'mulchama." Rashbam says, when is this story dated? It is dated to the second year of the wilderness, to the first of the second month. Maybe let me elaborate. The Israelites come out in the month of Nisan in the first year in the wilderness. They come out, they cross the Red Sea. They stand at the foot of Mount Sinai and hear God speak with them, hear the God boom out the Ten Commandments. Moses goes up the mountain. We have the sin of the golden calf, and this is followed by Moses coming down with the second tablets. They build the tabernacle, which is set up on the first of the first month in the second year. They celebrate Passover in the second year. And now what? What's the plan? Where do we go from here? The answer, we have to travel through the wilderness to the promised land, to the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. Okay, well, if that is what is next on the agenda. And let me add that if you look at chapter 10, verse 10, you will see that very, very soon the Israelites are going to break camp. If you take the date of Parshat Bamidbar, not 20 days later, the Israelites break camp and start marching to Eretz Israel, to the land of Israel. And therefore, why would we count 20 days before departure? The Rashbam says, because now, since we need to go to the land of Israel, we need to conquer the land, and anybody who is above the age of 20 should be drafted for the war effort. And this is the reason why now we have to count the people. This is quite fascinating, that the atmosphere at the beginning of Bamidbar should be military. And when this maybe helps us understand a shift of tone, whereas the book of Vayikra has been focused on law, focused on purity, focused on setting up a civic society, we now realize that the role of the book of Bamidbar is to transition. We've been in camp for a year at Mount Sinai. Now it's time to move away from the place where we receive the law and to move to our land and put that law into action. And in order to do that, we need to travel. But even before that, we need to ensure that we have a fighting force which can conquer the land. And this might explain why some of the frequently used language that we have here, where we talk about Pekudehem lemate Yehuda, Pekudehem lemate Yisachar. Pekudehem means somebody who takes orders. In modern Hebrew, a mefaked is an army captain. And Pekud is somebody, a Pekuda is an order in the army. In chapter 2, we see the phrase which is called Degel Machaneh. Everything is called a Machaneh, a war camp, where each group and each tribe has a Degel, has a standard, has a flag, Utsva'o Ufudav, and their army and their number of people. But there is a very strong military aroma wafting above Parshat Bamidbar, and this would certainly seem to back the opinion of the Rashbam that we're actually planning on going to war. That's why we have to count people, we have to organize the military force, organize them into divisions and a chain of command so that we can go and conquer promised land. Approach number one, the Rashbam. Let's go to approach number two. Rashi. Rashi, probably the first word in commentary as we usually experience it. And Rashi goes in a completely different direction. Rashi says the following. Mitoch chibatam lefanav mone otam kol sha'a. Rashi begins by talking about love. He says that God loves us so much, he counts us again and again. When we came out of Egypt, he counted us. After the golden calf, he counted us to know how many survived. While we were constructing the tabernacle. And now yet again, he counts us. Why? Because he loves us so much. Now, this is a fascinating interpretation. But really, does counting indicate love? You know, I have four children. Do I always walk around going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4? I guess when the kids are little and you're visiting the zoo and you don't want to lose them, you do have to count and make sure they're with you all the time. But is love expressed by counting something? I think we might try and adopt a slightly different interpretation of what this count is. It's not so much counting, but rather maybe we might say in English, taking account. If somebody has a beloved collection, I don't know whether it's a stamp collection, it might be a collection of rare books, it might be, I don't know, a collection of china mugs or something like that. Whatever you collect, frequently a person will reorganize them, go through them, look at them on a regular basis, because they give the person enjoyment. And when you look at them, you'll look at how each one is special, how you particularly like, you know, the color on this one or the curve on that one or what have you. When you really like something, you do tend to go through it over and over again. Maybe you can think about somebody who is leafing through their photo album, remembering a happy occasion, a wedding or a vacation or what have you. And you've seen the pictures before. They're not new to you. You go through them because they give you a wonderful, warm feeling inside. Now, of course, here we wonder whether really counting the people in a form of a census would really do that. And I mentioned before, when I mentioned the Rashbam, that there is a lot of military language here. But if we go back to the opening lines of the Parsha, we will actually discover that there is a whole different set of language which is being used. And that is the following. If you look at the opening line of the parsha, this is what it says. It tells us to count the people, Se'u et Rosh Kol Adat B'nei Yisrael, which literally means count. Sorry, Se'u can mean count, but I want to translate it differently. Se'u, lift up the heads of all the community of the children of Israel by their families, by their parental homes or their ancestral houses, by a count of names, each male by his head. Now, this is not military language. It's also not a standard counting because, of course, if you want to know how many soldiers you have, just give each soldier a number. Why do you need to know them by their ancestral clans? Why do you need to know Mishpachotam, their family, Beit Avotam, their father's names, Bemispar Shemot, each person's actual name? What is this all about? In fact, I'd say more than that. Frequently, if we want to dehumanize somebody, we give them a number. We have a prisoner gets a number. Frequently, you want to dehumanize somebody, you take away their name. But here, they are counted by their names, by their families. If I can express this maybe a little more, I'll read a line from the Ramban, where the Ramban says, God said to Moshe, count them with honor and greatness to each one. Don't say to the head of the family, how many are in your family? How many children do you have? But rather, let each individual come before you with honor and with awe, and you will count them. What are we referring to here? And here I would like to quote a short passage from Rabbi Soloveitchik in a wonderful essay called The Community. And this is what he says about the notion of our names. Quite often, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, a man finds himself in a crowd amongst strangers. He feels lonely. No one knows him. No one cares for him. No one is concerned with him. It is again an existential experience. He begins to doubt his ontological worth. This leads to an alienation from the crowd surrounding him. Suddenly, someone taps him on the shoulder and says, aren't you Mr. So-and-so? I've heard so much about you. In a fraction of a second, his awareness changes. An alien being turns into a fellow member of an existential community. What brought about the change? The recognition by somebody, the word, end of quote. Well, Soloveitchik is telling us an experience that we've frequently probably felt. When we're maybe away from home, when we're in a place where we don't know too many people, and we really begin to start questioning our significance, until we see somebody we know, or somebody says to us, oh, don't I know your sister, don't I know your grandfather? And suddenly you've got something to talk about. Suddenly you exchange names. Oh, yes, my cousin went to your elementary school. Suddenly you feel like a person again. You found a friend. They recognize who you are. What I'm saying is that Rashi focuses on the love of counting. And what is that? Well, let's explain. The first phrase, Mispar Shemot. He counts you by the number of names. Each of us have a name. A name is an identity. In fact, the Midrash in Parashat Vayakhel says a person has three names. You have the name that your parents give you. Maybe let's explain that by saying your parents' expectations, the way your parents raised you. That's name number one. Number two, the name your community gives you. In other words, your community gives you an identity. It's the school you attended, the college you went to, the company you work for, the area in which you live. And frequently, people don't get beyond that in a conversation. They'll just ask you, who do you work for? What do you do? What is your profession? Where do you live? And they don't know too much about you. They know something very generic. The Midrash says there's a third name, not the name your parents gives you, not the name the community gives you, but the name you make for yourself. God counts us for Mispar Shemot, because he's not counting us. He is taking account of each and every one of us. And therefore, he wants to know all about us. What is my name? Who is my father? Who is my family? What is my unique history? What is my story? As Moshe is instructed to count the people, he isn't told count. He's told raise the heads of the people. And now let me go back to Rashi. Rashi says, when did God count us? When we came out of Egypt. When the golden calf happened. And now again, after the Mishkan, the tabernacle has been set up. We might put it this way. Each time there is a major national occurrence, frequently we can hide amongst the majority. And we can say, well, I don't matter. There's just a mass of people out there. But God is saying, I want to count you. You matter. We're coming out of Egypt. We're setting up a people. What role are you going to play? What verse can you contribute? When there's a tragedy like the golden calf, well, how could you have stopped it happening? How did you exert influence in order to ensure that it didn't happen? Or did you participate, possibly? Were you merely a bystander and let it happen? You have a name. You have an identity. You're part of a family. Don't you realize your role, your calling? And once again now, as now we have reached a certain maturation level in our national existence, the Torah has been given, the tabernacle has been set up, and we're on the cusp of going to Eretz Yisrael. This isn't a mere technical account, says Rashi. Count. This is, says Rashi, a question of what is everybody's worth. What can you contribute to the national effort? So this is our second understanding of what counting is about. And again, I have to stress, it's fascinating the way that these two verses sit alongside each other. The first verse, raise up the heads of all the community of Israel by their families, by their ancestral homes, in a count of names. That sounds like Rashi's explanation. The very next verse, from 20 years old and upwards, everybody who goes out to the army, tifgudu otam litzivotam, command them, give them orders by their armies, you and Aharon. It's almost like Rashi is reading verse 2 and the Rashbam is reading verse 3. However, I'd like to move on to a third approach, which is going to focus less on the counting and more on the encampment, because chapter 2 in our parasha takes all of these ancestral divisions, these different tribes, the tribe of Reuven and Shimon and Levi and Issachar and Zebulun and Binyamin and Ephraim and Manasseh, etc., etc., and takes all of the different tribes and gives us a camp plan, a plan of encampment whereby the people know how they are meant to encamp when they are in the wilderness. According to all the explanations we've said so far, what exactly is the encampment about? But when you open chapter 2, you see something unique. Ish al diglob otot lebeit avotam yachanu b'nei Yisrael mineged saviv lo'ohel mo'ed yachanu. When they encamp, they should encamp around the tent of meeting, around the tabernacle. And this is repeated in chapter 2, verse 17, where it even tells us that when they travel, the Ka'asher Yachanu Kenisau Ishal Yadol Diglehem, we have a sense of even the Mishkan being, the tabernacle being at the center of the camp. The Ohel Mo'ed Machanel Viyim will travel at the center of the camp. When they encamp, it is at the center. When they travel, the Mishkan, God's holy abode, is still at the center. There is a sense that this camp is not merely a camp of a mass of many hundreds of thousands of individuals, a war camp, Rashbam, or a camp of significant people and families, but it is more than that. We are encamped, mineged saviv ohel mo'ed. There is a hub, there is a center. I always find this remarkable because the words that are used here are mineged saviv lo'ohel mo'ed, that we encamp mineged. Now, neged usually means opposite, right? It's actually, neged means against. And then there is that word saviv, which means around. All of Israel camp around this hub, this center, which is the temple, the tent of meeting, the tabernacle. But the two words which you use seem to move in opposite directions. One is mineged, opposite, in other words, against. The other one is saviv, around, where we all know that in a circle, the force is to the center. And I find these words dissonant from one another. It's almost as if there is an attraction and a repulsion at the same time. Mineged saviv. There's a sort of a dynamic relationship of almost opposing forces and mixture as we surround the Mishkan. Saviv, the force is in. Mineged, the force is pushing us away. What does that mean? And when I think about this, I think about the fact that back at Mount Sinai, a very similar thing happened. You know, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to celebrate Shavuot. And there we read about the Israelites standing at the foot of Mount Sinai listening to God. They had to put a fence around Mount Sinai because they were so worried that the people would rush onto the mountain in order to have contact with the divine. In other words, they anticipated that there would be an inward pull. And yet, when God started speaking, it was intimidating and scary, and the people ran away. It's fascinating. When it comes to God, do we have an attraction? Or do we have a force which distances us? I have to say that as a religious person myself, I think I experience both of those things regularly. Sometimes I can't get close enough to religion. I want to pray. I want to learn Torah. I want to do mitzvot. I want to be more deeply involved in my Judaism. And that is a saviv relationship, a relationship which pulls me, attracts me, magnetizes me. But then there are again moments where I feel a relationship of mineged, a force which wants to distance me. It's all too much. It's too claustrophobic. I'm not inspired. I want to, like Israel at the foot of Mount Sinai, I want to run away a little bit. I want to have a little bit of distance. I want to move aside, move away. It's fascinating that we are sort of enwrapped in this dynamic relationship with this hub which represents the Ohel Moed, the notion of meeting God, the law, because of course at the epicenter of the tabernacle are the tablets of the law. And therefore what I'm saying is that part of this very interesting census and count and reorganization of the camp is that we all have a relationship with God. We are all in a certain locus, in a certain position, a certain coordinate to the Mishkan, to this Ohel Moed, this tent of meeting. And we're all going to experience that double relationship, mineged saviv. On the one hand, we have the saviv, the pull-in. On the other hand, mineged, the repulsion. We have difficulties at time. Some people have more difficulties and less attraction. Other people have far more attraction and less difficulties. But I would imagine that every Jew experiences some sort of a hybrid of these contradictory emotions at different times. That is our nature. It shouldn't come as a disturbing fact. We should realize it's there from the very essence. And therefore, this is another fascinating issue. We're not just counting a war camp. We're not just taking account of the people, but the people are being organized as a nation around their spiritual center. And this brings me to my last point that I'd like to stress, because as I'm recording this before Parshat Bamidbar, next Sunday is Yom Yerushalayim. It is the day in which the Kotel was freed, was liberated, and Jerusalem as a city reunited. In 1967, in the Six-Day War, the order was given by the Israeli government to capture the old city, and that was the first time in 19 years when Jerusalem had been reunited, and when Jews could go back and pray at the Western Wall. Generally, we don't go and pray on the Temple Mount itself, which is our holiest site. Some people say that the holiest site is the Western Wall, but really for Jews, the holiest site is Har HaBayit. Maybe it's so holy, the Temple Mount, that we don't go up there very much, and we certainly don't pray there. We pray down below, keeping a little bit of distance. And it's fascinating that wherever you are in the world, every synagogue in the world is directed, it is oriented towards Jerusalem. The Talmud in Masechet Brachot, page 35, tells us, and they draw it from the prayer of Solomon at the construction of the temple, that wherever we are, we always face Jerusalem. If we're anywhere around the globe, we face the land of Israel. Within the land of Israel, we face Jerusalem. So, for example, my home is south of Jerusalem. I face north. If I'm praying from China or Hong Kong, I will face west. If I'm in America, I'll face east, Mizrach, etc. And Jerusalem's always at the center. In Israel, you face Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, you face the Temple Mount. And it's a fascinating notion that we're all sort of, I don't know, we're all located in a certain amazing attraction to this potent center. It's almost like going back to the wilderness times when the entire Jewish camp was centered around this tabernacle. Still, in some sense, the Jewish people are always seen as encamped around God, around Jerusalem. For some people, this attraction is a source of joy. It is something that we can sit with very, very comfortably, and people come to visit Israel, they come to Jerusalem, and they feel, wow, I'm home. This is wonderful. I've been pining to come back here. I feel the holiness and what have you. For other people around the world, coming to Jerusalem is a little bit of like visiting somebody you know you've got to visit, an aunt that you have to visit, but it isn't always a pleasant experience. It's sometimes a little bit heavy, a little bit overwhelming, not always the place they want to be. And yet, hopefully, we all feel this, that our existence as Jews is somehow connected to this very special place, Yerushalayim. It certainly has been at the center of Jewish life for thousands of years. And remembering Jerusalem has really been a byword of Jewish living. At every wedding, a glass is broken to remember Jerusalem. In every Seder table, L'shana haba Yerushalayim habnuya, next year in a rebuilt Jerusalem. The same thing at the end of Yom Kippur in so many shuls, the Shana Habab Yerushalayim, you are the hope that one day we will be reconstituted in our land. There is even a tradition that when a Jew builds a new home, builds a house, they should leave a little bit of the house, 1 cubit by 1 cubit, sort of 1.5 feet by 1.5 feet, should leave it empty. to say, I am not complete until I come back to Jerusalem. And this is a really remarkable unifying feature of the Jewish people. I hope that we can all think about what a remarkable occasion it was. This reunification of Jerusalem 49 years ago on Yom Yerushalayim. I'm fully aware that this is a very fraught political issue as well, and I'm not trying to iron over that. But I will say that our hope and our prayer is that in the course of time, Israel, still a young country, we can find a way in order to resolve many of the problems that we have, many of the, we can find a way to reach a state of peace and harmony, and that maybe the clouds which exist for certain people over Jerusalem can be lifted, that we can all really, really feel in our heart, in our mind, in our body, that very special connection to Jerusalem. And we will all be able to see, those of us in Israel, those of us outside Israel, that we are all somehow located in a beautiful circle of Jewish living around our center, around Yerushalayim, our Kodesh, Jerusalem, the holy city. Wishing you all a Shabbat Shalom and a very joyous Yom Yerushalayim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.